You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. Next up, Alan Robach. And then Heather Woodbury tells us about her new eco-comic series, As the Globe Warms. What if geoengineering to save the climate turns out badly? What could go wrong? Alan Robach has some questions and the science to back them up. As a distinguished professor of environmental science at Rutgers University, Alan has published over 200 peer-reviewed scientific papers. He's an editor at the important earth sciences journal called Reviews of Geophysics. Alan has been a lead author in the reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. Later, we'll also ask Dr. Robach about another application of climate science. What happens if there is an exchange of nuclear weapons? Could that stop global warming? Alan Robach, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Well, look, it's been 6 years since we last talked, and then you had a bunch of reasons why geoengineering might not be such a good idea. How is your list holding up?
Then I had 20 reasons. We're talking, by the way, about stratospheric aerosols emulating a volcanic eruption. The word geoengineering can apply to other things, but that's what I'm focusing on. Then I had 20 reasons why it might not be a good idea. I've crossed a couple off, but I've added some, and now I'm up to 26 reasons.
Okay, well, now I'd like to talk about, yes, as you say, solar radiation management, and that's where particles are injected into the atmosphere to cool the planet by blocking the sun, in a nutshell. And let's start with the smaller proposal in the polar region, as called for by the Arctic Methane Emergency Group. Talk to us, Alan, about what happens if we try limited solar radiation management to cool the Arctic. What did you find?
You can't just cool one part of the planet and keep it isolated from the rest. There's no walls in the atmosphere. So our climate model simulations show that if you try to put a cloud in the atmosphere over the Arctic, it will actually be blown by the winds to lower latitudes and affect the climate of the entire hemisphere, if not the planet.
Well, so that would affect what? In North America, could it affect our crops here or in Russia?
Well, first of all, we don't know how to do geoengineering. No technology currently exists, and so we don't even know if it's possible. There are ideas of flying airplanes up and spraying sulfur gas out and having it form particles like after large volcanic eruptions, but we don't know whether we could form particles of the desired size to have the effects that people have talked about. So, but assuming that you could do it, it would cool the Asian continent more than the ocean, and it would reduce the summer monsoon winds and summer monsoon rainfall. And so our simulations show that there would be a reduction of rainfall in a region where a couple billion people depend on it for their food supply.
And then looking at your graphs with the Arctic experiment, it looks like global mean temperatures go right back up to where they would have been within a decade or two of stopping injecting those aerosols into the atmosphere. Why would we stop once we start?
Well, that's true of any such scheme. Imagine you start doing geoengineering and there's a big drought in China or floods in India, and they say, you damn geoengineers, you're causing this. We demand that you stop it. And you say, well, there's natural variability. You can't prove that this flood or drought wouldn't have happened anyway. They say, we don't care. We think you're doing it. Stop. And so it would be very difficult to continue doing it in the light of that. And so I can imagine that society would lose the will or the means to do it, or some other catastrophic weather event happened, and whether or not you could connect it to the geoengineering, people would connect it and demand that it be stopped.
What sort of experiment did you run for injecting these in the tropics with larger amounts?
We organized this geoengineering model intercomparison project where climate modeling groups from around the world did the same experiment, and we compared the results of the climate models. And so one experiment we did was just turning down the sun and balancing an increase of carbon dioxide. Another was to spray sulfur into the tropics and let the winds carry it around the world like they do after volcanic eruptions. In these cases, we did find a reduction of the summer monsoon precipitation in Africa and Asia. There are a lot of other things we found, too, but that was one of the things that we found.
But it does look like injecting a lot of pollution above the tropics could really cool the planet by as much as 1 degree C from where it would be with our current emissions. So can we say, Alan, that geoengineering, if we could do it, could work?
Well, if we could do it, yes. So I have a list of 5 reasons why you might want to do it. And the number one benefit is that it could reduce the warming caused by greenhouse gases. And so it would reduce the negative impacts of global warming. It could reduce the extreme weather, extreme rainfall events. It could reduce sea level rise and sea ice melting. And it would then push back against what's being caused by global warming.
And you've raised twice now one of the biggest worries, and that is that the impact on precipitation could be greater than the effect on temperature. Is it possible, as you've just talked about, that billions of people could have their crops affected?
There's a lot of variability in the weather, in the precipitation. So sometimes the monsoon is not as strong as other years, and some years it's stronger, and so the statistics would change, and it could affect the food supply because of the impacts on precipitation. We've actually run a crop model to look at in the future if there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but it doesn't get much warmer and the precipitation changes a little bit, how it would affect crop production in China, which is the area with the largest crop production in the world. And we did not find a large impact on crop production in that instance, partly because the increased carbon dioxide acts as a fertilizer and makes crops grow better. We need a lot more work on that for all the crops around the world and for different scenarios, and we're in the middle of working on that right now. But it doesn't look like there's a dramatic change in agricultural productivity because of geoengineering. So although it's something to be worried about, we haven't shown that it's a deal breaker at this point. That's why we need more research, both to look at the benefits and the risks so we can make informed policy decisions in the future.
So you would support the new call from the U.S. National Academy of Science for more research into geoengineering?
Yes, yes. It was an excellent report written by a very excellent team of people. I testified to them. I reviewed it, and I agree with all of their recommendations.
I guess an obvious question is, what happens to the billions of dollars spent on solar energy if we darken the sky to cool things off?
If you darken the sky by 1% or 2% at the most, that's how much you would lose in solar energy that's produced by solar photovoltaic cells, the normal solar panels like I have on my roof. The other technique, which is focusing the direct sunlight in massive plants to boil water or some other liquid, is more efficient. That would be dramatically affected by this procedure because you would have much less direct sunlight and a lot more diffuse sunlight. So the sky would be hazy, and so the direct sunlight might be reduced by 10, 20, 30%. After the Mount Pinatubo eruption in 1991, such factories, such solar generation plants did have a 34% reduction of solar generation that next summer. So those systems would be dramatically affected. Solar photovoltaics would have a very small impact.
So humans could actually make the sky more white than blue?
Yes.
Ouch.
And I gave a talk about this in China once, and I said there'd be no more blue skies, and the students looked at me and they didn't know what I was talking about. So in very polluted places, of course, there's no more blue sky anymore anyway, but in clean areas, the sky would be whiter, and there have been studies calculating how much whiter it would be, and it depends on how much you put up, of course, and what the size of the particles are.
Do you think that the management of solar radiation could affect the ozone layer, and what would that mean?
Definitely. There's chlorine up in the stratosphere now because of our emission of freons and other gases. And every spring over Antarctica, we get the ozone hole because clouds form in the stratosphere and chemical reactions take place on the cloud droplets that release the chlorine and it destroys ozone. The chlorine is going to be there for decades into the future, even though we've stopped emitting it. So if you put a cloud into the stratosphere globally by doing geoengineering, these same reactions would take place globally and you would have ozone depletion. And that would allow more ultraviolet radiation to reach the surface.
Which could increase cancer rates, for one thing.
It would increase cancer rates. It would affect lots of all life on Earth, not just humans.
Right. So, Alan, in the end, do you think we will become so desperate or so wedded to fossil fuels that we really will inject pollution into the sky to block the sun?
So I'm a good weather forecaster. I'm not such a good forecaster of human behavior, but right now I think no. I think the governance aspects will not be soluble. How do we set the planetary thermostat? How do we decide what temperature we want the planet to be? Nations where it's cold, like Canada, Russia, maybe in the U.S., wouldn't mind a little bit of warming because you could exploit the Arctic, but islands that are drowning in the tropics right now would like it to be even cooler than it is now. We suffered through the Hurricane Sandy here at the Jersey Shore 2 years ago, and it was more dangerous because of the global warming that's taken place already. The sea level is higher, so there was more flooding. The storm was stronger because the ocean is warmer. This terrible typhoon that hit Vanuatu a few days ago was stronger and more dangerous because of the global warming that's taken place already. And so I don't know how we could decide how to manage the planet.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, talking with the famous scientist Alan Robach from Rutgers. Alan, we've talked about cooling down the Earth, but you have another area of expertise which finds a way we might be able to stop global warming altogether, and that's an old-fashioned nuclear war. Could that really stop climate change?
Yeah. Geoengineering, as risky as it might be, wouldn't kill people directly. But if you drop bombs on cities, killing millions of people, and produce fires, the smoke from the fires would make it very cold for a decade or two. What would stop global warming is that it would destroy civilization, and we would stop burning fossil fuels. Mm. I don't recommend that, by the way.
Not a good solution. So what is nuclear winter? Could you please describe it?
Nuclear weapons are targeted at cities and industrial areas, and unfortunately we have the example that cities burn. We have San Francisco after the fire in 1906, and we have a number of cities during World War II targeted by conventional weapons as well as nuclear weapons. The smoke would go up into the atmosphere, heated by the sun and lofted into the stratosphere where there's no rain to wash it out. It would last for a couple decades and absorb sunlight and block out the sun. If there was a war between the United States and Russia, there would be enough smoke to make it so cold that it would get below freezing in the summertime in the middle of continents. And so we call that nuclear winter. The temperature would be, it would be winter time all the time. We've also studied a scenario of a so-called small nuclear war between India and Pakistan on the other side of the world, using only 50 Hiroshima-sized atomic bombs, the smallest ones that can be made, and that would produce so much smoke that it would cause climate change unprecedented in recorded human history, and it wouldn't be below freezing, so it wouldn't be nuclear winter. But we've calculated how it would affect agricultural production in the United States and China. We're working on other places, and it would reduce the production of grains, rice and wheat, by 20 to 40% for 5 years and up to 30% for a decade. And so this would be a huge reduction of the food supply on the planet, and you can imagine after this people would stop trading food, there would be panic there, and there would be famine.
Now, wait a minute. You're saying what we would call a small nuclear war, if there is any such thing, between India and Pakistan would affect crops in North America and possibly in Europe as well?
Oh, it would affect crops around the world because the smoke would go up into the atmosphere and be blown around the world, so it would have global climatic impacts, yes. It's hard to imagine, you know, along the Kashmiri border. So what if there's a fight between India and Pakistan? We don't have to worry about it, but it would really affect us.
Well, okay, so that says we have all of us a stake in making sure nuclear weapons never get used. But it's so confusing that the instability in Pakistan, we can't affect policy much in India. We have apparently no control over what North Korea does with their nuclear weapons. What can we do?
North Korea doesn't have enough nuclear weapons to do this, but all the other 8 countries that have nuclear weapons could do this. The solution, of course, is to ban nuclear weapons. Chemical weapons have been banned internationally. Biological weapons have been banned. Landmines have been banned. Cluster munitions have been banned. But the worst weapon of mass destruction of all, nuclear weapons, have not been banned. And so it turns out the situation is not mutual assured destruction. It's self-assured destruction. If one country attacked another and the other country did nothing back, the climate change from the smoke from those fires would come back to hurt everybody in the country that did the attacking. And so the solution is just to get rid of the nuclear weapons. We'd be much safer without them. And this is an easier problem to solve than global warming, because the amount of money, the amount of people's careers invested in nuclear weapons is much smaller than the entire world energy structure.
Have we done a sociological study to find out whether we really could manage the geopolitical situation without nuclear weapons? I mean, we've built up a world that kind of depends on these ultimate threats.
Well, but the threat it's only a threat if you believe people would actually use the weapons. I mean, they don't provide a deterrence. Look at all the examples of nuclear nations that have been attacked by non-nuclear nations where they have not deterred them. We can look at the Falkland Islands, where Argentina attacked nuclear UK. We can look at the Afghanistan war, where two nuclear nations ended up losing, Russia and the United States. We can look at the 6 Days War in Israel, where Israel was attacked and they were a nuclear nation. Did nuclear weapons stop Russia, the Soviet Union, from invading Eastern Europe after World War II when we were the only nuclear nation? They don't work as a deterrent.
And I keep hearing rumors that America's thinking about updating their nuclear arsenal or spending more billions on new ones. What's happening with that, do you know?
It's not a rumor. I mean, the plans are to spend over $300 billion over the next decade modernizing our nuclear weapons, maybe up to $1 trillion. What's really dangerous is our missiles. They're launch on warning, because missiles in the ground, if they are attacked, they can't be used. Missiles on submarines, on airplanes are virtually invulnerable. So we have a system where if we think we're being attacked, we have only a few minutes to decide whether to launch our weapons or to lose them. If we would take these off launch on warning and get rid of our land-based missiles, the whole world would be much more stable. That would be the first step to take. And President Obama can reduce our nuclear arsenal without an agreement with Russia. I talked to Rose Gottmuller, his nuclear aide, a little more than a year ago, and I said, why doesn't he just reduce our nuclear weapons? He doesn't need an agreement with Putin. This would set an example. I mean, how can we expect Iran not to have nuclear weapons if we keep ours? It's like you're sitting in a bar drinking, telling people not to drink. Why should they listen to you? And so if Obama wants to really make us think that he deserves the Nobel Peace Prize, this is what he has to do for his legacy. Just take our weapons off launch on warning and start getting rid of our nuclear weapons. And she said, oh, we can't do that. We can't do that. And I said, but actually there's a precedent. George H.W. Bush started reducing our nuclear weapons without the Russians as the Soviet Union was coming apart. Oh, that was different. That was different. But she didn't really explain why. So it's very frustrating to me that Obama is doing some things like changing our relationship to Cuba, doing more on global warming. But this is an issue where he hasn't really done what he said he was going to do.
And it's been 25 years since the original nuclear winter work. Are we more sure now with newer science that this would happen?
Yes. The first models, the global climate models that were run in the 1980s, were run on the Cray-1 computer, which was much less powerful than the iPhone in your pocket. Now we have modern computers and modern computer models that can do multiple simulations over many years, over many decades, using the entire atmosphere. And the more we look at it in more detail, the surer we are that the science was right. It's pretty simple. If you block out the sun, it gets cold. And so, it turns out with our modern computer models, we discovered that the smoke would last much longer than we thought before, because now the models have the sun heat the smoke and lofted it into the upper stratosphere, lasting much longer than we thought before.
How long is much longer?
Well, we only ran them for a year or two before, and we didn't have the first simulations ran for 20 days. Now we know that after a couple decades before the smoke will disappear.
Wow, there wouldn't be much living left underneath that. So in New York City this past February, the well-known anti-nuclear campaigner Helen Caldicott just held a symposium on the dynamics of nuclear extinction. You spoke there, I know that. I've got a recording of the audio, and people can find that, a link to that, in my blog at ecoshock.info. Is that going too far? Could we really go extinct as a species due to nuclear weapons?
I don't think so. Helen stayed at my house the night before and gave a talk at Rutgers, too. It's hard to imagine that humans would go extinct. 74,000 years ago, there was the Toba volcanic eruption, which put so much stuff in the atmosphere, it got very cold as it would get with nuclear winter. It's called a volcanic winter. And we think that a lot of humans died, but there was a human genetic bottleneck, and we're all descended from the people that were lucky enough or smart enough to survive. Even that didn't kill all the humans. Now there's so many more humans, some far spread around the world. There's no nuclear weapons in the Southern Hemisphere. And so people in the Southern Hemisphere, if you lived in New Zealand, there'd be a lot of sheep and mussels to eat and fish, and it wouldn't get as cold because you're surrounded by an ocean with a lot of heat capacity. So it's hard to imagine that you'd go to a more primitive lifestyle. You know, modern medicines and computers and stuff would be out of commission for a while, but it's hard to imagine that we would go extinct.
And yet I still don't feel very good about the whole topic.
No. it could be horrible without us going extinct. There's no reason to get to that point, of course.
And, you know, it's hard to find a less popular topic than nuclear weapons. Most people would rather not hear about it and plan to avoid thinking about it. What can we do? I mean, you've talked a little bit about what we could do to protect the long future, but in the face of this fear and apathy, can we get any public support for changing it?
It's very frustrating. I give talks and people get depressed, and I try to tell them, you know, how we can change it at the end, but you know, it's like Mark Twain said, denial ain't just a river in Egypt. People want to pretend that they never heard about it, and just like you said, it's pretty frustrating. We had Carl Sagan to help us in the 1980s, who was such an excellent communicator, but he's not around, and so we haven't been able to find a spokesman who's as eloquent as he is. I asked Neil deGrasse Tyson to include it in his recent Cosmos show, but he said he wasn't going to do it. So we're still trying to get more attention to this. Maybe the Nobel Peace Prize this year, every 10 years it seems to be about a nuclear issue. Maybe it'll be to somebody who can raise this issue again. But I had this surreal experience of being invited down to Cuba to give my talk about nuclear winter, and Fidel Castro listened for an hour, and afterwards he blogged that we have to get rid of all of our nuclear weapons. And so he got it, but he doesn't have any nuclear weapons anymore. So we need the countries that have them to stop thinking of nuclear weapons as just bigger bombs, bigger bullets, and understand the consequences. And it's pretty frustrating. We keep trying to get people's attention, but if you have any ideas, I'd like to hear them.
Well, part of it is just to try and get the word out through this radio program. You know, Alan, as we wrap up, I've always thought of nuclear weapons as a sign of basic insanity in the human race, and now we want to control the climate, the weather, and the rain with the same mentality. I'm wondering if we should add basic human insanity to your list of reasons why geoengineering may not be such a good idea.
Well, Donald Rumsfeld was right about one thing. There are unknown unknowns, and so we don't really know what we don't know about what would happen. I mean, would you trust the whole world to this one technical solution? I mean, anybody who is in a car today and had their seatbelt on understands this concept. Anything made by humans and operated by humans can not function, can break or be operated poorly. And so that's one of the reasons why it would be very scary to try and control the whole world on purpose like this.
From New Jersey, we've been speaking with the Distinguished Professor of Climate Science at Rutgers University, Dr. Alan Robach. You can find links to his website, more notes and audio from his recent talk in New York City, and the 20 reasons why geoengineering may be a bad idea, all in my show blog at ecoshock.info. Alan, we've only talked a couple of times, but I do consider you to be a friend of the future. Thank you for sharing your time with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.